Most Las Vegans know Douglas Unger for his writing. He teaches at UNLV and has written four acclaimed novels, including Leaving the Land, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. But he has also had some difficult personal encounters with death. He struggled to get his brother hospice care. The deaths of his first wife and his aunt, he says, have also had a big impact on him. Hospice care is, most of us know, for the end of life. Unger says when his brother had about 7 months to live, they checked out several hospices and decided on Nathan Adelson Hospice. But in the end, Unger was left to care for his brother because the facility would not admit him. Joining us now to talk about his experiences caring for his terminally ill brother, his first wife, and his aunt is Douglas Unger. Doug, welcome back to the program.
Hi, good to be here, and I'd like to just say hello, especially to all those families who may be facing a terminal illness and considering home care and all the different options and what's going to be necessary to go through, especially in the planning stages, and send a heartfelt blessing and support out to those families who are going through the last stages of the death and dying of a loved one.
Speaking of the loved ones, one of the chapters in this story, if you will, has to do with your brother Harry. Tell us a little bit about him and about the illness that he had at the end of his life.
Well, we had a very unusual relationship, my brother and me. Harry, we called him Steve. His name was Harry Stephen Unger. And he was a 100% disabled Vietnam veteran and joined my family very soon after he was released from Army and Veterans Hospitals. And we lived through many, many years of him being hospitalized and released, hospitalized and released. And he became a part of our nuclear family for 30 years. And so when he was diagnosed with lung cancer, and by the way, he had quit smoking many, many, many years before and was doing the best he could to lead a healthy life, eat well and exercise and as much as he could and all the rest, it was a great surprise and a shock. And of course, with the kind of lung cancer he had, the odds were not good. And we did the chemotherapy and all the therapy, and it became clear that it wasn't going to work. So in the last 5 to 7 months of his illness, we began to consider all the planning that was necessary for his death and worked through the VA and worked through Nathan Adelson Hospice to try to set him up on hospice care, and he was set up on hospice care. But my experience with that, having done this before, was that it was going to become very, very difficult at the end. I knew what it was going to be at the end with all of the gruesome and messy and physically demanding tasks that are required for bedside caregiving. My brother and I were so close and such good friends, really, that he did not want me doing that for him. Mm. He did not want me changing his diapers, literally, at the end.
Yeah, and this is in direct contrast to the you've said the registered nurse at the hospice put it on you to take care of your brother.
Well,
and what did she tell you?
Now, to be fair to the hospice, all they really provide, and if families who are going into end-of-life care should really know this when they're considering hospice care over the other options, is that hospice care is going to provide you with a registered nurse, care manager, who's going to visit your home about once every 2 weeks and see how things are going. And when things get really, really tough, when your loved one becomes bedridden and it's very difficult to do things for him or her, what you're going to get is probably 2 or at most 3 nurse's aide visits per week. And you're going to be responsible for the lion's share of the bedside care. Now, my brother and I had toured the facility at Nathan Adelson, and we had requested of our registered nurse care manager and of the hospice itself in that final week, in those final 2 weeks, perhaps, could we be guaranteed or could we check into the facility to avoid what my brother and I never wanted to do to our relationship was have me do all of that hands-on nursing care. In the end, the facility was full. They couldn't do it. They were spending days and days checking it out, trying to figure out a way to get him in, and they just couldn't find a place for him. Later on, after my brother died, I talked to the registered nurse caregiver, and he basically said, look, you know, I judged that you were fully capable of handling this yourself and your family was. And we have other patients in the community who needed the facility more. And that may be the nature of their nonprofit status and their philosophy of giving generously to the community. He told me the story of a woman in Henderson who had been doing bedside care for her husband of many years, who had just had a breakdown and literally got in her car and drove off and phoned the hospice and said, you're going to have to take care of him. There he is. He's in the home. I'm not going back. And apparently those are the kind of cases, or the cases who are left alone and without any support, that mainly get into the facility. Now, I could be wrong. This is just my experience.
But it sounds like it was a little bit overwhelming. And Adelson Hospice was being somewhat overwhelmed.
I think Adelson Hospice was overwhelmed. I also had the feeling afterwards that this was never in their plan for me and my family, that they were always going to leave me doing the messy business of the bedside care. Now, when that happened, my brother was conscious enough and still aware enough so that we made that all right between us. I mean, we made the agreement that, yes, we're going to go through this. And I arranged for some outside nursing care to cover me when I was at work and so forth. And I did have that cash pay assistance, and I'm fortunate to be able to have been able to do that. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I was the major caregiver for my wife, Carola, and I, too. Carola was providing the meals and so forth. But when it came to all the very tough and embarrassing physical business of dying, he preferred that my wife left the room while I did all of the bedside business.
You did that work. At any point in this process, did Adelson attempt to get you placed elsewhere? Did they try to make contact with other hospices?
That I don't know. I got some phone calls from them. We had a nursing home option under my brother's Veterans Administration care, and we thought about doing that, but had always wanted to get into the hospice. And at some point, then let's just say the death train leaves the station and the process has already begun, and it's going to last 3 to 4 to 5 days at the end. And then the movement itself becomes such a monumental shift in the dynamic of a family and a home and what's going on there that maybe it's better that it did not happen that way, that we didn't move him to one of the nursing homes that would have been possible to move him to.
Yeah. Now, at the same time, you've said you felt that hospice care promised more than it delivered. Flesh that out a little bit for us.
Well, I remember touring the facility, and I recall my brother being very content with the idea of dying in that wonderful facility they have over, very near UNLV, and talking it over with the registered nurse caregiver and making a plan, reinforcing that plan 3 or 4 times. And I don't want to single out Nathan Adelson Hospice either, because most hospice care organizations, and I think families need to know this, really only provide a few basic services. They're going to train the family to deal with the death. They're going to help to make the death happen in the home. And what they're going to provide basically is what I've outlined, a registered nurse caregiver who visits once every 2 weeks, maybe a little more often, a couple of nurses aide or LPN, licensed practical nurse, visits to the bedside per week, and medications delivered to the door. That's about it. Post-death grief counseling, all the rest they provide as well. But if you really look at, and I've looked at the bills that were charged to the Veterans Administration, it was about $4,000 a month. And I'm going to say here that I couldn't see more than $1,000 worth of, per month in medications and actual hands-on care. But I don't think Adelson Hospice is any different than many other hospice organizations. On the other hand, on their website, they have volunteers listed and other services listed. And my question at the end of it was, where were these volunteers who could spell me before caregiver burnout?
Yeah. And did you ask them directly?
I asked them for any kind of help they could give me. And basically, it was hurry up and wait. And then the caregiver came one extra time on a Sunday night the week my brother died, and made a very unusual statement to me, which was that, well, we think he's going to go in the next 24 hours. And, of course, I said, no, he's not. He's a you know, he's a strong guy. He's gonna hang on for the rest of the week, which he almost did.
Mm-hmm. As you look back on it, what was the biggest challenge for you in caring for your brother Steve?
That's difficult. Fortunately, I'm very used to all the kind of medical and physical things that one does at the bedside, having been through the experience two times before. Mm. So I was prepared for it. I think the biggest challenge for me was to try to help my brother shift his attitude toward his own dying into something positive, rather than living in the sense of anger, not really anger, but the sense of deep disappointment at his own early death.
So it sounds like he hadn't really made his peace with that yet.
He felt as though it were terrifically unfair with everything that he had been through in life and everything that he had been through in the Vietnam War and the difficulties of his life, that now that he had reached some sense of how to be healthy, he felt for approximately the last 10 years of his life, that now this had happened. And talking through those issues, also talking through difficult family issues and helping him to arrive at a better attitude toward those, this was all a part of what I like to call the healing of the dying process. And I've come to believe that you know, terminal illness is extremely difficult to face, and the one reality about terminal illness is there is no cure. But that does not mean that we cannot achieve healing the disease through the process of dying. And the challenge was, and it took a lot of good talk and work with my wife and my younger brother who visited, to really help him come to terms not only with the achievements of his life and what his life meant, but also his relationships with our family and how to feel good about those and how to feel good about his journey on the earth. And I think we managed that. I'm convinced we did achieve that and manage that.
Douglas Unger is an author and English professor at UNLV. He cared for relatives at the end of their lives, including his wife and his brother. Doug Unger, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Dave.
Just a few moments ago, we heard that when his brother was suffering from lung cancer and losing consciousness at home, Doug Unger had arranged to move him into hospice care. But as it turned out at that point, Nathan Adelson Hospice did not have room. So Harry Stephen Unger was cared for by his brother in the final weeks of his life. Hospice care is a $14 billion a year business in the U.S., and the need continues to grow everywhere, including here in Southern Nevada. With that growth comes challenges, including having enough space to care for the dying. And joining us now is Lynn Stang, who is Chief Compliance Officer with Nathan Adelson Hospice. Lynn Stang, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
You heard Doug Unger's story about having to care for his dying brother with little assistance from qualified nursing. How common is a situation like that in Las Vegas?
Well, first of all, I'd like to, apologize or say that I'm very sorry that Mr. Unger had the experience that he did. That's not typical for our company, nor do I think it's typical for a lot of other hospices within the community. Unfortunately, sometimes there is situations where inpatient units can be full at the time that a patient would like to come in or their family would like for them to come in, but there are other opportunities for patients and their families. We do contract with hospitals, local hospitals, and as Mr. Unger mentioned, we also contract with local skilled nursing facilities where patients can go in the interim until a bed opens up in our inpatient unit or an inpatient unit.
Is it unusual to have a situation of the sort that Doug Unger was talking about where every bed is full, basically? Have you noticed that at Adelson Hospice more and more with the passage of time?
I wouldn't say that it's a typical pattern. I think it varies by a lot of different factors, the time of year, you know, how many people are in the hospital, those circumstances. So I wouldn't say that it's a typical pattern.
Yeah. So if a room is not available, what is available for home care? What can hospice provide at the end of life when it can't provide a bed in a facility such as Adelson?
We do have an interdisciplinary team approach, which involves a social worker, nurse, a CNA, a chaplain, and then we do also have volunteer services who can provide support in the home.
Are there enough hospice beds overall in Southern Nevada, or does the industry ultimately need to find a way to fund more facilities?
I'm not really sure that I'm in a position to answer that question.
Well, as somebody who's in the middle of this area, when you look around, does Adelson Hospice, would you like to have more beds? And have you heard any stories about this field?
From my perspective, for Nathan Adelson Hospice, I would say that we have enough beds. We have not considered expanding.
Mm-hmm. Now, also joining us is Jennifer Kirkland. She is an adjunct faculty member of the hospice program at Mandana University in Livonia, Michigan. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us. It's a privilege to be here.
We've talked with hospice nurses over time who say it is their job not to prepare a person to live, but to prepare a person to die. Can you tell us how you train students to deal with that eventuality?
Absolutely. And first, I'd like to start by saying that Mr. Unger had mentioned about healing as part of the dying process, and I think that's a great place to start to answer the question, because there is so much healing going on there. And talking about preparing patients to live or die, we're overall focusing on quality of life, celebrating somebody's life, and making sure in a hospice plan of care that physically, emotionally, and spiritually, patient and family are getting what they need to have. So this can be the best quality experience that it possibly could be with everything considered. At Mandana University, we have some very special and specific programming that deals with teaching and preparing professionals to be a part of that bereavement process, to be a part of the end-of-life care movement, shall I put it, to understand from a family's perspective, a patient's perspective, even from a practitioner's perspective on how to prepare for what's coming, realistically for what's coming, how to put options out there and empower people to make choices that are going to get their expectations met, to really build that trust, that comfort, and that confidence.
When you speak of preparing people for what's coming, I would imagine that this applies to students as well. And I'm wondering, Jennifer Kirkland, how you prepare students for the psychological and emotional stress of dealing with death and dying. They are going to be around it a lot, needless to say. How do you get them ready for that?
Generally speaking, first to answer the question is, as students are interested in working in hospice and end-of-life care, there's a compassion, an interest, and a commitment for whatever has happened in their life or in their interest that they want to be in that place of healthcare. So we take a look at, one, preparing students with history, theoretical framework, and understanding interventions and why. And then most specifically, our teams take our students out into field placement to give them hands-on preparation and work with local facilities that are here, be it hospitals, nursing homes, hospice, assisted living, really working in the community hands-on with trained and experienced mentors, teachers, and preceptors to be there and help them understand, answer their questions, guide them, and really prepare them for what they're going to be doing in their lifelong career choice.
Do these students know what they're going to be getting into with this? I mean, when you first encounter these students who are in the hospice program at Mandana University, do they have an understanding at least at the very beginning of what this field is going to entail?
That's a great question. It's really different case by case, because at our school here, we're privileged to have students that come to us that are either just starting off in their career, or they're coming back to us. Maybe they've been a nurse, or they've been a therapist, or they've been a practitioner in one part of the continuum of healthcare. And because of their experiences of wanting to learn to up their skills, so to speak, because they've been working with patients and families that are dealing with chronic disease management and ultimately looking at how do we get the best quality of care out of life and how do I provide that, sometimes it's their own personal and professional experiences that bring them to us because they want to better understand how to provide the best quality of care. Mm-hmm. So we have people from several different backgrounds that come into our end-of-life care program. So, yes, there are some folks that are coming in that have an understanding from the beginning, and then there's others that come in that have an idea of what they think is going to be involved. And then it's our job to help them find their path and their way through getting their skill set and their comfort and confidence to go out in the world and really lead the hospice movement.
We are talking about the hospice care in Southern Nevada. The end-of-life care industry is now a $14 billion a year business in the United States. There have been stories, however, of patients turned away, or stories of some providers taking in patients who are not near death and maybe are not eligible for hospice. We are talking with Jennifer Kirkland, an adjunct faculty member of the hospice program at Medina University in Livonia, Michigan, and Lynn Stang, chief compliance officer for Nathan Adelson Hospice. If you have an experience with hospice care, has your family had a member who used hospice care at the end of life? Do you have questions about how hospice care works? Would you recommend it if you have had this experience to others when their time comes? Join our conversation. You can call us at 702-258-3552. That's 702-258-3552. You can also write us at knprnews.org. And we are on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at knprnews. Lynn Stagg, I want to ask a little bit about how hospices are regulated. You have said that there are inspections of Nathan Adelson Hospice. Who does the inspections and how often do they occur?
The Nevada State Health Division does regular inspections of all hospices. The standard time is usually 3 years. Our particular last survey was in May of 2011, so we would be due, you know, fairly soon. So there are state and federal regulations. So the federal regulations come from CMS, that's Medicare, and then there's also state regulations that we must adhere to. And then in addition to that, our particular program is Joint Commission accredited. So we have an inspection by them as well every 3 years, and we just completed our inspection in February of this year.
Are the results made public from these inspections?
Yes, they are. You can access the inspection results on the internet for both the state inspection that we had, and then you can also see the Joint Commission results.
When people are looking over these health department reports, what should they be looking for if they are looking for possibilities for placing a loved one who's dying? What should they be checking out?
If somebody was looking for a particular hospice program and they were looking at the inspection reports of several different hospices they were considering, they would want to be looking to see if the hospice had any citations related to actual care of patients versus paper type compliance issues. So an example would be if the hospice had a citation for the plan of care, that could be a paper related issue where something wasn't completed timely versus a care related issue such as somebody who had a wound that wasn't treated properly. So that would definitely be more significant, and that would be something that a potential patient family would want to be looking at and pay attention to.
Jennifer Kirkland, hospice care has evolved. I'd alluded to the kind of the charitable roots of hospice care at its very beginning, but it's now a $14 billion a year business. Is the industry doing everything it can to ensure quality care for the dying?
I believe the industry is doing everything and more, because our consumer demands it, as they should. And what I mean by that is we're looking at a population that's aging now at a historical rate. Our population of folks that are over 65 that have been dealing with chronic disease management, and our folks that are now over the age of 85 that are living longer with these chronic illnesses are looking for options, and they're coming to us and saying, we want to be comfortable, we want to have a great life, and we need to know what happens next. Family members are coming to us and saying, how does this work? What do we do? How do we make the right quality decisions for our family and for ourselves? And the practitioners, physicians, nurses, hospitals are looking to us and saying, how do we work on providing what our folks need out in the community? So I really feel strongly that not only are we looked at every day that we're doing the right thing and that we're maintaining a high level of care, but we are wide open and transparent to being able to not only doing that every day, but doing it better and better each time. Because it's what we are here for, and truly in hospice care, we get one chance to give that patient and family what it is that they need, and the privilege for our teams to be a part of their family unit. Our goal is to make it work and to make that trust, that comfort, and confidence be there. So we only have that choice, as we all want it, to make sure that we are in compliance and that we're raising our standards daily.
So, Jennifer Kirkland, when making plans for a loved one, how willing do people have to be to change the plans if things happen, if beds are unavailable all of a sudden? We heard Doug Unger's story of caring for mm-hmm. his brother. The care that he provided was not the care that he had originally planned for. Mm-hmm. How flexible do family members and loved ones need to be when caring for the dying?
Dave, that's an excellent question. And to answer it, I want to start by saying that that answer, that conversation, even comes from the very beginning of a patient and family deciding that they want to take a look at hospice care. And when they're talking with their hospice team and they're talking about that plan of care, of really understanding what are their expectations and goals and how can that hospice team fulfill them, what is realistic, what is allowable, what happens if mom or dad is feeling one way today, but as their illness progresses and they become more sick, are they going to need more care? Is hospice going to change that plan of care? What happens along the way? So in being flexible is really taking a look at the changing needs of that patient. Now, when you're talking about location of care, that's also very specific to every patient and family case. Whether it's a general inpatient stay or you're staying in a hospice home, the care is going to be in a private residence, in a family member's home, and an assisted living, and so on. Looking at where care starts, it's also critical that the hospice team and the family and patient have that open line of comfortable, confident communication to understand if a change happens, what are our options? And in looking at hospices, I always encourage folks to ask, where can I get hospice care with your team? Are you contracted with certain skilled nursing facilities if I needed a bed there? Do you have a hospice home? Will the care always be in my home? I've worked with patients and families over the years. I had one case where the husband and wife, and he wanted his wife's hospice care to start in their home, but he was very clear. His family did not want their mom and their wife to die at home. That was not part of their wishes. So they worked with the hospice team to see, could we actually make that happen out there, and what did that look like? So there can be very specific cases, but it all comes back to that open communication about what to expect and what is available. Because when the family and the patient need to make that choice, they need to make that choice and know that they're confident in making it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's the hardest part, is knowing that you made that right choice, because sometimes there's no going back.
Lynn Stang,
and always wondering, did I choose right? And mm-hmm. our job as hospice is to help families really understand and make that choice that works for them.
So, Lynn Stang, when trying to make that right choice as to what works for them, when things change, or if there's maybe a turn of events or a change in health or something, how ready do families have to be to make the changes themselves, to kind of adapt to what's going on? If a patient becomes worse, or a patient perhaps becomes better or wants to go someplace else, Do you ever encounter situations where the family's got to be flexible in ways that they hadn't perhaps planned?
Yes, that does happen. I mean, the dying experience is very personal, and it's very difficult and challenging. You have family members generally who were unprepared to begin with in terms of advanced care planning. They hadn't maybe thought about it or discussed it as a family or as a group, and now they're having to make all of these decisions, and it can be very, very challenging. And so, yes, unfortunately, they have to be flexible during a very, very difficult time. So you have all these emotions that are running very high, and yet you're being asked to make decisions. But it is our role as the hospice to help facilitate that and guide them and support them. And that's why we have such an interdisciplinary team. If we have one member of the family who is having a spiritual crisis, we have somebody that can assist with that. If we have issues with maybe applying for Medicaid for different funding, we can assist with that through social services. Maybe they don't have resources for a daily food, or there's a challenge with getting food into the home. We have meal delivery. So we try to assist them and guide them through this very difficult process. We call it navigation. And we're just trying to foster the process for them as make it as positive as it can be, and take some of the stress away by offering a variety of services and remembering that each case is individual, each patient is individual, as is their family.
We are talking about hospice care in Southern Nevada with Lynn Stang, Chief Compliance Officer for Nathan Adelson Hospice, and Jennifer Kirkland, an adjunct faculty member of the hospice program at Madonna University in Livonia, Michigan. If you have questions about hospice care or you have some experiences you would like to share with us, please contact us right now. Give us a call at 702-258-3552. That's 702-258-3552, or write to us at knprnews.org. Lynn Stang, give us some idea of what a hospice unit looks like. Paint a picture for us, if you would.
Well, most hospice inpatient units have private rooms. We have two different units. We have one at Swenson, which Mr. Unger mentioned, and then we also have one in Tenaya, which is located in the Mountain View Hospital. It occupies a portion of a floor there. So all of our rooms are private, and generally most inpatient units in the community do have private rooms. For our unit at Swenson, we have private patios, which is really nice for families to be able to open those patio doors and have fresh air for themselves and for the patient. We have meal services, which are available to the patient and their family 24 hours a day. It really is meant to be a place where families can come together with the patient at the end and be able to be there with them as long or as much as they want to. They can sleep there and stay there. We provide a place for the family to rest and lie down. We have beautiful courtyards where people can go out and enjoy the outdoors. We have a chapel as well for private prayer time. We also, like to support people knowing that they're working, that they have things going on in their life. So if they need to make phone calls or do faxing or anything like that, we can definitely support them in that as well.
Now, you also offer home hospice care. Yes. What does that involve?
So home hospice care, usually our first encounter with the patient and their family is in the hospital. So maybe somebody's been recently diagnosed and there's a referral made. And so one of our team members would go to the hospital and make an introduction to the patient and their family and discuss our services and, what we have to offer. And then if they decide to proceed with us, then a case manager is assigned. And so when the patient is discharged to their home, then we make a visit to see them there and set up services, whatever those services might be. If they, need the chaplain or the social worker, or they need a CNA to come in with personal care, that's when we set up the plan of care with the patient and the family. Mm-hmm. So it's meant to be collaborative.
Are there times when home hospice care is not appropriate, where people with Adelson Hospice can kind of look at a situation or assess a situation and say, this is probably not the best option for you?
Sometimes that happens if the patient gets into a crisis situation where the symptoms aren't being able to be managed in the home setting. Maybe the person is, in a lot of pain or having difficulty breathing, or even sometimes the patient or the family says, we're just really uncomfortable. We have small children in the home, and this is really difficult for the children to see grandpa or grandma going through this stressful time. And that's definitely a time then we begin to discuss the option of transitioning into an inpatient setting.
Mm-hmm. Hospice is about easing pain and ensuring a dignified death. How do you do that? How do you make sure that happens in this process?
I think a lot of it has to do with individuality, really getting to know the patient and the family, what their capabilities are, what their desires are, because again, it's a personal experience. People have different expectations going into it, and they also have different ideas of what it's going to look like. And so it's kind of assisting and navigating through that with them and figuring out what that might look like. We had this was years ago. I worked for Nathan Adelson 8 years ago. And at that time, we had a patient who was a Buddhist living in our inpatient unit at Swenson. And their request was that he be able to die facing east and outdoors. And so as it was getting close, our team actually took the bed out onto the patio and had the bed facing east, and then the man peacefully passed away. Those are the things that are meaningful to staff and to us, and we want to make possible for our patients, honoring those very specific personal requests at a very personal time.
Jennifer Kirkland, one of the other elements of hospice care is the management of pain. What do you teach your students about what's appropriate and what's not when it comes to pain management?
Well, there's a couple of different aspects there. We teach our students that they're taking a look in the assessment process ongoing throughout the entire hospice experience. Where is that pain coming from? Are we looking at physical pain, emotional pain, spiritual pain, psychosocial pain? Looking at that root cause of where things are coming from, and then knowing how to appropriately design interventions that are going to help ease that pain and suffering. So it could vary in those categories, and it could also vary with the interdisciplinary team on who's going to lead that. Is the nurse leading that? Is our bereavement and spiritual team leading that? Is our psychosocial team leading that? Sometimes it's our music therapist that is involved. So it could be that collaborative approach. It could also be taking a look at what type of response are we getting from certain interventions, be it medications or, as I'm saying, if it's spiritual intervention or psychosocial intervention. As Lynn has been saying, it's very individual, personal experience, but the overall goal of what we're doing in hospice care is to provide comfort and ease pain and suffering. And how that looks for each patient and family is critical to that patient and family. And part of our job is to really get in there and get involved and find out what that means and how we can best support. And under the Medicare hospice benefit, hospices are given all of those team members and resources to be able to give that type of attention that patients and families deserve. So I realize that's a general answer, not very specific as to specific interventions under each interdisciplinary team member, but I believe that would best answer the question without looking at a specific case.
Lynn Stang, in our final half minute or so, death is a part of the process of life, but a lot of people have not properly planned for death. What do we need to do better to prepare ourselves for the end of life?
I think it starts with a conversation. I think that, you know, families need to get together and discuss, you know, what people's wishes are at the end. And it can be very hard to do. We at Nathan Adelson have kind of sponsored a program that talks about having the discussion. You know, we do a lot of advanced care planning seminars in the community to assist patients and their families so that you're having that discussion well in advance of needing it, so it's not a crisis. So everybody at the table understands exactly what each other is looking for and who's the decision maker, and which would be the patient, but what are their needs and wants and desires, so everybody understands that. And then also making sure that you have written that down so that people can follow it.
Lynn Stang is Chief Compliance Officer with Nathan Adelson Hospice. Jennifer Kirkland is an adjunct faculty member with the hospice program at Mandata University in Livonia, Michigan. Lynn and Jennifer, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Dave, thank you for having us. And on behalf of Mandata University, we really want to acknowledge you for bringing attention to this topic for your listeners. It's very important, and we are proud to be here.
Well, thanks very much.